It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joined a multi-state lawsuit against the Trump administration over restrictions to grant funding from the Victims of Crime Act, known as VOCA. The Department of Justice is seeking to block states from accessing those federal funds if they don't assist the Department of Homeland Security with immigration enforcement. Wisconsin receives over $24 million in VOCA grant funding that it distributes to over 100 victim service providers who are already grappling with previous federal funding cuts. We're checking in with two of those organizations to find out how their services are being impacted and what challenges could come with additional funding loss. Holly Fisher is Director of Family Services of Northeast Wisconsin. Holly, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Cheryl Cotto is Executive Director of the Rainbow Project, a Madison nonprofit focused on trauma and grief counseling for young people who have experienced violence in their communities. Cheryl, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Cheryl, can you start us off? What does the Rainbow Project use these VOCA grant funds for?
Well, it really is critical to respond not only to the crisis referrals that we're receiving, but the ongoing trauma recovery programs that we have. And that has been increasing in terms of our waiting list. We have been unfortunately lost approximately, it really is the equivalent of over 1,700 24 hours a year that were lost in terms of the ability to serve children and families. So that is about $260,000. So it has been very devastating. We've already had a waiting list, and the right service at the right time, we know, is what is most effective.
Holly, same question. What kind of services do you do with the help of these VOCA grants?
So VOCA funding supports sexual assault victim advocacy in four counties in Northeast Wisconsin, three of which are rural. We also provide culturally specific victim advocacy services for Hmong and Spanish speaking communities. We also provide advocacy for children who have suffered abuse or neglect, and we've also utilized VOCA funds for assisting with therapy costs for victims of any type of crime.
And Holly, Cheryl had mentioned the impact of previous cuts. Now, I want to make clear, we hear a lot about federal funding cuts. These cuts go back over the course of years now. What kind of changes have you seen, and how has it affected your ability to provide those services?
We received an 87 decrease in our award starting last year in 2024. So it's definitely impacted our ability to provide that barrier-free therapy for victims of crime. We are no longer able to offer emergency financial assistance for safety planning with victims of crime, such as providing window and door alarms, security cameras to assist with that safety and stabilization after victimization. Many of our advocate positions are currently unfunded, so we've had to increase our fundraising activities, which takes away from, obviously, services we're able to provide for victims.
Cheryl, have you been seeking or maybe even successfully finding ways to fill in for some of those VOCA funds as they've been cut?
Well, we certainly have been, and that is increasing daily, it feels. And I think one of the things that we're realizing, even in crisis, is that research is showing if you're able to really intervene and stabilize when a child is exposed to gun violence, for example, if you can get in within the first 3 to 4 weeks, you can stabilize and really prevent future post-traumatic stress disorder. And those are some challenging things that we're facing now in terms of the ability to respond, because those kinds of calls are increasing in domestic violence, in child abuse, in child sexual abuse, human trafficking. And what we're unfortunately finding is that there's an increase in full beds in the inpatient hospitals for outpatient psychiatry. And that tells us that when you chip away at some of those community mental health services, you really are going to see much more serious mental health problems occurring.
Holly, can you talk about the impact your services have when they're available for victims of sexual assault?
Absolutely. So we provide 24/7 response. So anytime a victim presents to the hospital in need of a sexual assault nurse exam, or if they're reporting their crime to law enforcement, an advocate is there and lets them know their options and stays with them throughout the criminal justice process, which takes years. So we work closely with the district attorney's office, law enforcement jurisdictions, because we know that having that victim connected to an advocate helps keep them engaged in the process, which ultimately holds offenders accountable and keeps communities safer.
We were talking about federal funding for victim services in Wisconsin with Holly Fisher, Director of Family Services of Northeast Wisconsin, and Cheryl Cotto, Executive Director of the Rainbow Project, a Madison nonprofit. In the news right now, the state's attorney general challenging a Trump administration directive saying, hey, we're going to stop this funding if states don't cooperate with our immigration enforcement. Cheryl, I don't want to ask you to get too deep into the politics, but the concept of blocking this funding, freezing it completely because of an unrelated issue, what would you say to policymakers about that? What concerns would you raise?
Well, I think already what we're seeing, if we're talking about funds, it would be $592 billion of an economic burden. When you think about some of the costs in investigating, in foster care, in medical care, in mental health care, in the juvenile courts, adult courts, addictions, and other health problems from untreated trauma, that really is not going to be saving any money for the communities. And so we're really very concerned that we're at a crisis level already with waiting lists everywhere for all ages. And to have the right service at the right time is critical. And we're seeing the savings that we can make already. We are 45 years of service this month. We are celebrating that, and over 27,500 children and families. And we're sometimes working with three generations. So the cost savings is actually something that is significant and needs to be thought about in terms of dollars as well as in human cost.
And Holly, if policymakers are to ask you, hey, what happens if this goes through and these funds are completely frozen, what would you tell them?
I would say it would be extremely disheartening to the residents in the state of Wisconsin, because we should care about crime victims and getting them the resources they need to heal and move forward. Interpersonal violence is a public health issue. You know, domestic violence, sexual violence, those are very common in our society. And Congress didn't authorize the US DOJ to impose conditions on the VOCA grant. So to tie those two together would really be a disservice to victims in the state of Wisconsin and reduce their access to resources.
Holly, your organization teamed up with a bunch of others in northeastern Wisconsin to try and raise funds to make up for the past federal cuts and some of the uncertainty surrounding it. How is that partnership playing out?
It's been a great collaborative. We knew we needed to come together as a region because our region has lost almost $1.8 million annually in VOCA funding. So over the next 3 years, we'll be losing over $5 million in VOCA funding. So we knew that we needed to come together to sustain these services, because advocacy services for victims of crime are free and confidential. And we want to keep it that way so that victims are able to come forward and reduce the barriers they're facing.
Cheryl, you've already talked about how you're dealing with past cuts. How are you preparing for this possibility if this carrot and stick method of saying, hey, we're going to cut this VOCA funding if you don't cooperate in immigration, how are you preparing for that possibility of being zeroed out, in effect, in this funding?
Well, that is definitely something that is on our minds every day. And, you know, week to week, we're not quite sure. But we are all the more fortified, I think, and determined to really work together. And I think collaboration at a local level, too, has been important for all of us. I think that kind of seamless response systemically, because we have mutual families and helping each other out, is going to be critical because of the less resources available. It's going to be really challenging, but all the more families need so many more, and we're very much determined to overcome those adversarial kinds of funding decisions and really working together. And so we do have coalitions, and we are working even more intensely, meeting, and we're thinking about a conference in November just to talk about all the things that we're working on, because untreated trauma, when you're thinking about it, is really going to impact employment, the ability to maintain housing, the ability to really succeed academically. All of those things systemically are going to impact our communities immediately and long term.
And we'll leave it there. Cheryl, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Holly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Holly Fisher is Director of Family Services of Northeast Wisconsin, and Cheryl Cotto is Executive Director of the Rainbow Project, a Madison nonprofit focused on trauma and grief counseling for young people who have experienced violence in their communities. They're with us today to share how they count on Victims of Crime Act grant funding, as Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call signed onto a lawsuit against the Trump administration, potentially putting restrictions on those funds if states don't cooperate with immigration enforcement. Coming up, a UW Stout professor is a new Fulbright scholar who will teach and further her research in couples therapy, doing it at a university in Istanbul, Turkey.
I certainly don't want to change up the curriculum. You know, I want to do what I can to fit in, but obviously it will be very different coming from someone from the United States.
Preparing to teach family therapy in the Middle East, that conversation is ahead on Wisconsin Today. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin scientists are leaders in a worldwide effort to test psychedelic drugs and treatments for mental health conditions. They're hoping drugs that have been traditionally used recreationally, even illegally, may have clinical applications. WPR's Anna Marie Yanni spoke with researchers who say their trials could persuade federal regulators to make the drug in magic mushrooms the first psychedelic approved for this kind of treatment.
Becca Cassanda is a mosaic artist in Milwaukee. She's also training to be an art therapist. And years ago, she was haunted by trauma that led to post-traumatic stress disorder. Today, though, she says thoughts that used to preoccupy her mind barely stick around.
And I felt like I was like a volcano ready to explode at any time before, because there was so much under the surface with that trauma. And it's just like, it's not even part of my reality at all anymore.
In 2020, Cassanda had tried talk therapy and other therapies, but nothing stuck. It was then she enrolled in a nationwide trial through the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It was testing the drug MDMA in a therapeutic treatment for PTSD. She says even as a therapist trainee, she hasn't found a treatment that compares.
I feel like there's like a permanent change with it. I don't feel like I have any risk in sort of slipping back into it.
Last summer, federal regulators rejected MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, sending it back to the lab for more testing. But that trial was part of a broader movement to see whether psychedelic drugs might have real clinical applications to help people with depression, addiction, and PTSD. And in Wisconsin, researchers say there's promise in another psychedelic drug, psilocybin.
We have a lot of nature artwork and some plants in here because
In this room on UW-Madison's campus, clinical psychologist and neuroscientist Christopher Nicholas helps guide people through psychedelic treatments. Psilocybin is the psychoactive ingredient in magic mushrooms. It triggers hours-long hallucinations and sometimes intense trips. So for the trial, participants settle into a room that looks more like a living room than someone's lab.
So they often wear headphones, listen to instrumental music, and we really encourage them to just be within their experience.
Researchers like Nicholas are hopeful psychedelic drugs paired with therapy will offer them a new tool for patients. He worked on a 2023 study that found participants' depression scores improved about 6 weeks after a single dose of psilocybin. Psychiatrist Charles Raison led that study. He's a UW-Madison professor and a clinical director at the nearby USONA Institute. USONA makes psilocybin pills and protocols used in research trials across the country. It's also one of the few places worldwide to get FDA breakthrough therapy status for its psilocybin depression research. Raison is optimistic about these therapies.
They're going to help some people a lot. They're not going to help some people at all. Some people they'll help a little bit. It'll be like a lot of things, but that they will be new, they work differently than other agents we have, and they're going to be beneficial that way.
Not everyone is eligible. Scientists don't generally give psychedelics to people with psychotic disorders and high blood pressure for fear of exacerbating these conditions. But if approved, Raison's research predicts millions of people could be helped by the treatment. USONA is leading a nationwide trial testing the safety and efficacy of psilocybin treatment for major depressive disorder. And new federal leadership may work in their favor. U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently signaled federal support for psychedelic therapies. But company spokesperson Tura Patterson says ultimately, the data needs to stand on its own.
There may be a favorable attitude, but I think it is still going to come down to what the FDA requires for any new drug approval.
If psilocybin is approved, she says the Wisconsin Institute will be an educational leader for clinicians preparing to provide such treatments. Anna Marie Yanni, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today. An associate professor at UW-Stout is among 800 Americans who won a Fulbright U.S. scholarship this year. Candace Meyer will teach family therapy at Istanbul Bilgi University in Turkey. The university has more than 20,000 students, and its marriage and family therapy program is the first of its kind in the country. At UW-Stout, Candace is clinical director for its marriage and family therapy graduate degree program. She recently talked to Kate Archer-Kent about what she hopes to give and receive during her 6 months abroad next year.
You've talked about modernizing the field of marriage and family therapy. What aspects of the field do you identify for your students as needing to evolve?
Yeah, thank you. Well, the history of marriage and family therapy is really interesting in that it grew out of several different religious movements. And so you'll have some fairly, conservative, traditional, kind of steeped in that religious background in terms of the family and marriage and the sanctity of marriage and children and all of that, as well as the other side of the spectrum, which is how do you define family? Families look very different. And so, with the feminist movement in the field of marriage and family therapy, different intersecting waves of that, there have been more and more inclusivity, which we really need desperately in the field. And so part of that is for my students, not only educating them on the waves of feminism and intersecting identities, but also meeting clients where they're at. So, some of our students are, very, I would say, you know, liberal identifying, and you're going to meet with a family that really wants to hold on to their values around gender roles. And so how do you hold on to your values as a person, as a therapist, yet also meet people where they're at? So I feel like the modernization kind of goes both ways. It's about being humble, sitting back, hearing people. You know, we're really unique in our position as therapists in that we're, some of us are advocates, but we have to be subversive in our dialogues in terms of kind of where we meet people and not pushing our agendas.
And it seems like relationship values are always changing. I mean, you look at these movements that you mentioned, like a religious movement, but, you know, if you look in social media, there's trad wives and that whole school of thought. So, mm-hmm. I mean, as a therapist, you really have to perhaps look more broadly or be open to these other forms of influences in relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, depending on how you identify too as a therapist, right? So people have different what's called theoretical frameworks. And some are a little bit more maybe less feminist identifying, more what's called neutral, which I don't agree with. I don't believe you can be neutral as a therapist because we don't leave our values at the door. But I think, you know, not knowing where our clients are coming from. Per se, we don't want to alienate people from the get-go. So if I were to come in and say, I identify as a feminist family therapist, you know, how can I help you today? I may or may not say that, but I want to be mindful in terms of who I'm talking with, the audience. And yeah, I mean, again, if we were to just come in and kind of push our agendas on people, we probably wouldn't have very many clients at the end of the day, unless we're working in very selective, you know, types of communities.
As you make that greeting in Turkey, as a Fulbright mm-hmm. scholar, I wonder how that will be received. And can you talk more about what this mm-hmm. Fulbright will open up for you in your profession?
Yeah, absolutely. First off, I want to say thank you to my mentor. One of my mentors, Anne Prouty. Without her, I wouldn't have any of these connections. An American colleague collaborated with her and another colleague from Turkey, actually the university I'm going to be teaching at a few years back during COVID on feminist supervision practices. So just want to, pay odage to her, because again, without her, I would not have these connections at all. Mm. I'm very excited about the Fulbright. Very honored, very surprised to be selected. And I'm very mindful of my positionality as a white identifying cisgender, heterosexually married woman. And so certainly, you know, the origins of marriage and family therapy did stem from the United States, but since its origin certainly has been, you know, brought abroad by scholars and looks different in different countries. And so really mindful of my positionality coming in. Again, feminism looks different in Turkey. It looks different in the United States. And so, you know, gender inequality is a worldwide problem. It certainly looks different in different places, but being mindful is going to be my main priority, right? I don't want to, again, come in with a certain agenda. I'm really honored and humbled just to meet, other MFTs from a totally different background than me. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure we'll share some similarities and commonalities as well, but being really mindful of difference. And I'm learning from all of them just as much as I'm teaching in the classroom.
When you go to Turkey, you'll also be teaching in the first marriage and family therapy program in the country. And what are your teaching plans? What do you hope to accomplish with your new students?
Yeah, I hope they receive me okay. I am teaching. So personal story aside, I had a child, a baby 2 months ago. So the timing's a little, you know, not the most convenient, but I digress. So had I been able to choose the courses I was going to teach, I probably would have taught more in my area, which is couple relational therapy. So for the spring, I'm going to be teaching family group dynamics, as well as an adolescent family therapy course. And so One is an undergrad, one is a master's course for their students. So I'm going to be teaching their curriculum. I certainly don't want to change up the curriculum. You know, I want to do what I can to fit in, but obviously it will be very different coming from someone from the United States. My Turkish colleague has informed me that the department's never had an instructor from outside of Turkey. There. So yeah, I mean, it will be just different in and of itself, even if I'm teaching the same materials. And so I honestly don't know what to expect until I get there. I barely just gotten notice of what classes I'm going to teach. So I have a feeling it's going to be kind of a pace yourself, you know, buckle up your seatbelt type of thing. It's funny, I've had a couple of people say, well, won't you miss your children? And I'm like, oh no, they're coming with. They're two years old and 2 months old currently. So there's no way I'm leaving them. So yes, my partner, my husband, Joshua, and my two kids will come along for the ride.
Wow. What an experience. We're talking with licensed clinical therapist Candace Meyer, associate professor at UW Stout. She's a new Fulbright scholar who will teach at Istanbul Bilgi University for 6 months next year. Candace, you know, broadly speaking, do the dynamics of couples and how they treat their relationships and how they regard each other, are there more commonalities than differences in Turkish society compared to here and what we see here?
So, I mean, Turkey is really unique in that it serves as a bridge of, you know, Islamic traditions, which is steeped in patriarchy, in addition to holding some really modern values too. So lots of diversity, especially in a city like Istanbul. You know, it's just a really unique, I think, place within the larger country. So traditionally, the family in Turkey is patriarchal and gender roles are clear, meaning, you know, cis men are earning the money, holding power in family affairs, decision-making, so on and so forth. And women's domain is more so in housework and childcare. And it's interesting, even Turkish therapists are agreeing with these ideologies, with these scripts that yes, these, you know, the gender roles are clear, which shows up in their work with clients, right? If they're kind of reinforcing some of these more gender divided scripts, which isn't bad. Again, I want to stress gender inequality is a worldwide problem, as certainly in the United States as well. But yeah, I mean, couple and family relationships are an important part of this problem as people's experience with equality and inequality first develop within families and in family systems. So I'm not sure how off topic I'm getting here, but family therapists, I think, are really uniquely suited to implement, you know, feminist principles in terms of how they do that may look different, but into their work if they want to encourage more equity and fairness, which is tricky. I don't even think it's possible in some family systems. Again, we have to meet people where they're at. But there's likely a reason people come into therapy in the first place. I mean, therapy is taboo all over the world, definitely taboo in Turkey. So.
And that's so interesting because, and especially with clear gendered roles, you wonder what might be examples of marital tension in life in Istanbul that would bring a couple into therapy.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Good point. You know, I'll see some of that. The clients will be speaking Turkish, so unfortunately I won't know exactly what they're saying, but it is interesting. You know, it's a modern city. And so I can imagine all sorts of, you know, conflicting values around, again, men and women's roles in the relationship, in the marriage, in the family.
Candace, I wonder how you might change as a scholar and even as a therapist after going through this experience in Turkey.
Yeah, I think I'll change a lot. Anytime someone's pushed out of their comfort zone, I think you change in measurable ways that I probably can't even describe. I've been abroad before. I've been, you know, taken many international trips and also with my young children. And I just, it's a very unique experience and opportunity. You know, I hope that it translates in my teaching with students in terms of, again, being humbled by different family systems, not thinking you know it all. I knew when I was a master's student, I thought I knew a lot, right? And our students can be that way too, and they do know a lot. But I think this experience will change me in terms of reserving judgment You know, I'm a feminist identifying person, feminist identifying family therapist, and yet I need to be able to get along with the most traditional patriarchal family systems if I want to do my job well. And it's not necessarily about changing their values and their ways, but again, people come into therapy for a reason, right? And I do believe a lot of that stems from inequitable power imbalances. And so anyways, yeah, I will be changed a lot. And I hope that, again, that, you know, comes across some way in my teaching, my relationship with students. You know, we have a pretty diverse student base at our university as well. We have a lot of non-traditionally aged folks, second career folks, kind of from all different walks of life. And so, you know, hopefully they're learning from each other, but I really hope to bring just a humility, a kindness, understanding when I return next fall.
Hmm. That's so beautiful. And for your family personally, I mean, it's unlikely that your two young children will remember this time, that they'll remember this time abroad. What do you hope that your family will bring home with you after living in this environment?
That's a great question. I do hope the 2.5-year-old has some memory, because she'll almost be 3. And I thought memory started around that time. I don't know. I could be wrong. But it's very important to me. It's a really strong value I hold that they are exposed to people who are different than them. That's extremely important to me. I mean, living in rural Wisconsin. It's really important to me that they also are pushed out of their comfort zones. Hopefully not so much that they just completely hate the experience, but it will be hard. Mm-hmm. I know it'll be hard. You know, when they return, I'm sure it will have some reverse culture shock as well. But you know, they'll have their parents. My husband's amazing. You know, there'll be a lot of ups and downs, I'm sure. I'll tell you more about it when we return, but
oh, yeah. I look forward to it. Candace, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us. All the best to you.
Thank you so much, Kate.
That's clinical therapist Candace Meyer talking with Kate Archer-Kent. Meyer is an associate professor in the Marriage and Family Therapy graduate degree program at UW-Stout. She's gotten a Fulbright scholarship to teach in Istanbul in Turkey. Still ahead, Milwaukee astronaut Jim Lovell died this month. The journalist who co-wrote his memoir has a tribute to the Apollo 13 commander.
This was the man who said nothing more dramatic than, "Houston, we've had a problem," when his spacecraft blew up 200,000 miles from Earth. You know, there was little that would rattle Jim. There was little that would shake him into lyricism.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Apollo 13 astronaut and Milwaukee's own James Lovell died earlier this month at age 97. Born in Cleveland, Lovell and his mother moved to Milwaukee at an early age. That's where he attended high school and then enrolled in UW-Madison before entering the U.S. Naval Academy. Lovell ultimately became the first astronaut to go to space 4 times. He may be best known for his role in commanding Apollo 13 in 1970. The mission would have marked America's 3rd moon landing. But an explosion resulting from a damaged oxygen tank left the crew stranded hundreds of thousands of miles from Earth. Lovell piloted the craft back from the brink of disaster, where it landed in the South Pacific Ocean. Here he is reflecting on the view circling the moon and looking back at Earth during a 2016 commencement address he delivered at UW-Madison.
By holding my hand up at arm's length, I could completely blot out our planet with my thumb. And I suddenly realized how insignificant we all are. My impression of Earth was one of an incredibly beautiful blue and white ball, much like a Christmas tree ornament hung in an absolutely black sky.
Jeffrey Kluger is an editor-at-large for Time magazine. In 1994, he co-authored the memoir Lost Moon with Jim Lovell. Kluger spoke with Kate Archer Kent this week and starts by reflecting on what he remembers most about the late Milwaukee astronaut.
Jim was, you know, the astronauts back in the Gemini and Apollo days had a watchword when it came to Jim. And that was, if you can't get along with Jim Lovell, you can't get along with anyone. you know, people said there was a reason that he and Frank Borman were assigned to Gemini 7, which was basically 2 weeks in orbit without any spacewalks. So the doors, the hatches were never opened in a space the size of the front seat of a VW Beetle. You need somebody imperturbable, unflappable, and preternaturally genial to make a mission like that. And Jim was that person. You know, I found Jim not terribly taken with his fame and his celebrity. I just wrote Time's tribute to Jim last weekend right after he died. And, you know, I described him as a man who went to the moon twice, but was also, you know, a homeowner, a mortgage payer, and a father. And, you know, he just happened to have gone to the moon. And, you know, that was the humility and the nonchalance with which Jim wore his fame.
That's exactly the sentence in your tribute that stops me in my tracks, that Lovell was a naval officer, a father of four, a homeowner who just happened to have been in space.
Yeah.
How did Lovell feel about not getting to the moon? And did those feelings change over the decades and hundreds of hours in space?
I had an interesting conversation with Dave Scott once. Dave was the commander of Apollo 15. He walked on the moon in 1971. He was also, more to the point, in the pilot seat, the right-hand seat of Gemini 8 in 1966. Dave was supposed to be outside on a spacewalk for more than 2 hours, which means more than one complete circuit around the Earth. So the headlines in the papers before they flew was Dave Scott will be the first man to walk around the world. And he was incredibly excited for this. As it turned out, just 8 hours into the mission, a stuck thruster caused them to spin out of control. Armstrong managed to bring the spacecraft to heel, but he was only able to do that by activating the reentry thrusters. And once the reentry thrusters are activated, you have to come right home, because those thrusters, you can't deplete them at all, or you can't reenter safely. So most of the mission was aborted. Dave didn't get to be the first man to walk around the world. He didn't get to join Ed White in the pantheon of Americans who had walked in space. And yet he was early in his career and he knew he would fly again. And still, he told me, he said, I was heartbroken when I came back that I didn't get to fulfill my mission. And then he said, sort of, you know, on the QT, he said, if Lovell ever tells you that he didn't feel that way about Apollo 13, he's lying. And so that comes from another astronaut who knew what it was to lose a mission. You know, Jim, in his later years, when I was writing my book, Apollo 8, in 2015, I went out to visit him and Marilyn again. And he said, look, he said, if I had landed on the moon, I would have said a few words that nobody would have remembered. I would have been just one of 12 men who walked on the moon, 14 men who walked on the moon. We never would have had our movie. We never would have had our book. I never would have had the speaking engagements. He never would have had the speaking engagements that allowed him to buy and build his son a restaurant. His son is an executive chef. He said, so all things on balance, you know, I think it worked out as it was supposed to. On the other hand, as I said in that Time interview, one of the times I was in the Lovell house, I saw a bronzed baby shoe that Jim wore when he was just a toddler. And I thought how fitting it would have been for a lunar boot to be next to the baby shoe. Mm. But that lunar boot never got there. Jim never touched the moon.
He keeps his cool through some of the most harrowing circumstances in these missions. And you described Lovell as being lyrical, saying that there was music when he spoke. What do you mean by that?
I take that from a particular thing that he said to me right around the time our book and our movie were out. As I say in the time piece, you know, I have spent a career sort of quietly toiling as a science journalist. I enjoy some recognition for my work, but I certainly don't enjoy anything like the fame a lunar astronaut has. Jim knew about that fame. He knew about being sought out for interviews. He knew about being stopped on the street and recognized in restaurants. And he also knew that fame could be a fickle thing, that you splash down on a Tuesday and people forget about you on a Wednesday. And as a result, he said to me, this was right at the peak of all of the noise and all the publicity our movie and our book were getting. He said to me, remember where you're standing on the stage when the spotlight goes out, because nobody's going to help you out to the wings. And I thought, God, where did that come from? This was, you know, this was the man who said nothing more dramatic than, Houston, we've had a problem, when his spacecraft blew up 200,000 miles from Earth. You know, there was little that would rattle Jim. There was little that would shake him into lyricism. And yet he had that lyricism. And Jeff Lovell, his younger son, said there was a lot of that in Jim, and you just didn't see it publicly. But he was a man who could speak in rich metaphors and, you know, really illustrate his point with word pictures.
We're talking about the legacy of Jim Lovell, the Milwaukee astronaut who led the Apollo 13 mission. Jeffrey Kluger is here, editor-at-large for Time magazine, co-authored the memoir Lost Moon with Lovell in 1994. Take us way back. Lovell grows up in Milwaukee, starts his journey to space as an engineering student at UW-Madison, stays for a couple years. What was his relationship like with Milwaukee, and why did he ultimately become an astronaut?
Well, from the time he was a young boy, he had followed the exploits of the world's great rocketeers, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, Wernher von Braun, later on, Robert Goddard. And, you know, he was convinced that America's future, that humanity's future, lay not in aircraft, but in spacecraft. His connection to and passion for rocketry ran deep. His connection to Wisconsin ran deep, I think, as well. You know, he learned a lot from his upbringing. His father died when he was young. He was raised by a single mother. And I think he really liked the coziness and the familiarity of his hometown. And the only reason he left college was, or he left Wisconsin, was that he was accepted into the Naval Academy when he was 2 years into his college career. And he had to start all over as a freshman again. But I think he would have stayed in Wisconsin, and he may have lived in Wisconsin. You know, he certainly was there until he was selected by NASA. And then, like all of the astronauts, moved down to Houston.
Apollo 13 on the big screen is what we know from the outside. And, you know, the Apollo 13's damaged oxygen tank, spending, you know, two of the vessel's three fuel cells, spacecraft has to return to Earth. You know, conditions on the return were really rough. The crew enduring dehydration, sleep deprivation, near freezing temps. For multiple days, Lovell piloted the craft and ultimately led to a safe landing. What did he do right in this perilous situation in Apollo 13?
I think the biggest thing he did right was in the atmospherics, in the attitude, in the mood in the spacecraft. You know, I asked him if anyone panicked, if there was any moment of, you know, breakdown. And, you know, obviously, if somebody did, he wouldn't share it. But he said no. He said our attitude was, we can flip out, we can bounce off the walls for 10 minutes, and we're going to wind up right back where we are trying to figure out how to get home. So let's not waste our time and energy on emotion when we could better expend that time and energy on figuring out how to get home. He used solitaire, the game of solitaire, as a metaphor for the chances they had. And he said, you know, when you have a game of solitaire, as long as you have one more card to turn over, you're still alive. It's only when you're out of cards to turn over that the game is over and you've lost. And he said, and fortunately, we always had another card to turn over. There was always one more step they could take. You know, he welcomed Jack Swigert onto the team just 2 days before they were supposed to launch. I think if Jim hadn't done everything he could to make the Lovell, Mattingly, and Hayes team into the Lovell, Swigert, and Hayes team with just 48 hours to launch, I think if Jim hadn't kept that team together and forged those bonds amongst the three of them in that very short period, I don't think they would have worked as well together. You know, he told me, and this was a line that was in the movie, he told me when they were going around the far side of the moon, Fred and Jack had obviously not seen the moon up close before. Jim had seen it for 10 orbits on Apollo 8 just 2 years earlier, less than 2 years earlier. But Fred and Jack hadn't seen it, and they were, you know, sort of goggle-eyed at the window as they were going around the far side taking pictures. And Jim called their attention back to the matter at hand and said, "Gentlemen, what are your intentions?" And they put their cameras down and they went back to work. And, you know, they didn't get to do as much sightseeing as they would have liked to have done. But Jim kept them focused on the task at hand, which was keeping that spaceship in one piece and dog paddling back home.
Let's land on family. Jim Lovell names a triangular shaped mountain on the moon after his wife, Marilyn. And in 2017, the International Astronomical Union broke its longstanding rule for naming features or objects posthumously to recognize Mount Marilyn. Beyond the mountain, what do you consider Jim Lovell's legacy in the history of spaceflight and the, you know, what family means?
You know, there's a story I told in Apollo 8 of Jim proposing to Marilyn. And typically in the Naval Academy, if you were getting engaged, you would buy your fiance the small women's version of the Naval Academy ring, and that would be her engagement ring. And Jim was walking Marilyn by a jewelry store in Annapolis shortly before he graduated, and he looked in the window and just pointed to all of the women's rings and said, "So choose." And she said, "Choose." And he said, "Well, yes, for your engagement ring." And she said, "James Lovell, do you think I'm going to say yes if you don't ask me properly?" And on the sidewalk in Annapolis, in front of that jewelry store, Jim promptly dropped to one knee and proposed to Marilyn, his high school sweetheart. And again, as I say in the book, at that point, it was always true. If you can't get along with Jim Lovell, you cannot get along with anyone.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for the conversation and these remembrances.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to remember Jim.
That's Jeffrey Kluger talking with Kate Archer Kent this week. Kluger is an editor at large for Time magazine. He co-authored the book Lost Moon with Milwaukee astronaut Jim Lovell, who died this month at age 97. This interview came from an audience question as part of the Why Sconson Project. Submit your question at WPR.org/Why Sconson, and we might be able to track down an answer for you. Wildfire smoke has cleared up around Wisconsin after a bunch of bad days for air quality. We talked about the smoke, the causes, the risks last week, and how we measure air quality, and we asked if you have made any changes because of smoke this summer. Steph sent us this email. I wanted to share that I've been affected by the air quality. I play Ultimate Frisbee in Madison, and we've had our bi-weekly league canceled due to how bad the air quality was. We've also adjusted our Ultimate Frisbee practices and canceled some. The air quality index sadly has become a thing I check just as much as the weather. Growing up, this wasn't even a consideration, Steph says, but now with climate change, this is becoming more and more of an issue. A couple sad face emojis along the way there. How about you? Have you started watching that air quality index? Have you had to change plans because of air quality? Email us. Tell us about it. WisconsinToday@WPR.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Avery Lee Rogers, and Trevor Hook. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.